The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello. Welcome to episode 61 of The Commentary Track. I'm your genial host, Frank Thompson, in the new perfected Technicolor. We've got a really good one for you today. Actually, this is an episode of which I would like more. I'm talking to the great film historian Hugh Munro Neely, and we are talking about one subject alone, which is Ramona. And here's why we're talking about Ramona. For one thing, I've talked about Ramona with Hugh on many occasions. He goes up to Ramona Days at Rancho Camulo every year and shows the 1910 D.W. Griffith film with Barry Pickford as Ramona. That's where that film was made. So you can actually watch the film and then step right outside and you'll recognize everything you see, which is an incredibly cool experience, I'm guessing. I've never done it, but this year I'm definitely going to be there. But Hugh has another Ramona connection, and that is that he was one of the ones who helped to find and then steer toward restoration and preservation the 1928 version of Ramona with Dolores del Rio, directed by Edwin Carew, and we thought that was lost, but it's not lost. And happy us who live in Los Angeles and environs. It's going to be showing at the Billy Wilder Theater at the Hammer Museum, which is UCLA's screening room, on March 29th at 7:30 p.m. This newly restored print will be shown. The Mont Alto Orchestra will be accompanying it. Hugh will tell you a lot more details about that and also more details about people who will be there. This is a co-presentation by the UCLA Film and Television Archive and Diane Allen, who is the granddaughter of Edwin Carew. And there are also going to be other people, and again, he will fill you in on all that coming up. This is an interesting story, interesting because it was an incredibly influential novel. It became a part of the California mythos almost immediately after its publication and was made into the first film, as I said, in 1910. And then another film in 1916, and only one reel of that one survives. Now, this is where I need to do one of those corrections that seem to happen more and more frequently at the beginning of these things, because when we get through, we realize that somebody has slipped up. And in this case, both of us just stared at each other, trying to remember who directed the 1916 version. There was no real convenient way for us to look that up at the moment we were recording, so we just fumfered. But in fact, even though Hugh made a guess that it was Oscar Apfel, it was not. It was Donald Crisp, the director who turned actor and who, of course, we know and love from so many films such as John Ford's How Green Was My Valley, one of the greatest films ever made, says I. So Donald Crisp directed this, and only one reel, I think reel 5, exists at the Library of Congress. And if you'll go to my Facebook page, you will see a little gallery I did about Ramona, the authoress, Helen Hunt Jackson, the book itself, stills, posters, lobby cards from all of the film versions, and one really fascinating thing that I did not know until I started looking into this week. The 1916 version featured the film debut of a little girl who later became Anne Dvorak. So one of the great stars of the 30s started as a 4-year-old child in this 1916 film. And I have a still of her on the Facebook page. Just go to my Facebook page, Frank Thompson. You'll know which one is me because it's got all the Beaugest and Foreign Legion stuff and Alamo stuff, and it's clearly me. So go there, and then you'll see the album called Ramona, and you'll see, I think it's about 40 images, which is some really beautiful stuff in there. The 1936 version, which was, like me, in the new perfected Technicolor, starred the most beautiful woman who ever lived, besides my wife, of course, and that is Loretta Young. This is early 3-strip Technicolor, directed by Henry King, and it is a pure beauty to look at. I urge you to find any of the existing versions of Ramona. And the last thing is, and we only talk about this a little bit, but this year, I keep meaning to do this every year of my life. I've been in California for 21 years now, And every single one of those years, I say, this year, I'm going to the Ramona pageant. It's out in Hemet. It's been going since 1923. And they have hundreds of people in the cast. And the stage is not merely a stage, but is also the surrounding hills. And there are horses and wagons and Indians and settlers. And it just takes place in this huge arena, this amphitheater outside. It's just one of those California traditions that I've always wanted to do. This year, I swear to you, I'm going. If you want to go with Claire and me, just drop us a line. We'll go as a group. We'll take a picnic lunch. It'll be swell. This is an episode of the podcast that is honed down to one specific subject, and I like that. We had a great time talking Ramona, and it's a fascinating subject. And I wouldn't be surprised if other podcasts such as this came along in the future, where I find some expert on something or other, and we talk just about that. Not to say I don't enjoy the conversations where we just go all over the place, because really, that's me in a nutshell. But this is the highly focused and incredibly knowledgeable Human Ronili, and I think that you will really enjoy what you hear. So let's listen, and I will see you on the other side. Helen Hunt Jackson's novel Ramona is somewhat, I guess you could say it's the official California novel, isn't it? I mean, it, for the longest time, it really meant California to readers all over the world, didn't it?
Absolutely. And it was a tremendous part of the boosterism that California entrepreneurs engaged in through the late 19th century and up until really the 1930s.
It was written in the 1880s, 1888?
Yes. Is that about right? 1880, if I have this right, 1885, I think it was published. And Jackson was an elderly woman at that time. She was in her 60s, and she only lasted another year or so after it was published.
Wow.
So she didn't live to see what it had done. But it didn't start out as something that was designed to be, PR for California. It started out as essentially a social protest novel. Jackson was a travel writer, and she was part of an East Coast group of writers who were literary in nature and very highly thought of, although she was one of the more minor characters for a very long time. But she knew a lot of other major writers. And she attended a Chautauqua lecture given by a Native American Indian chief. And she was appalled when she learned the history of the way her government, the United States of America, had continually gone back on treaties made with the Native Americans. It really shocked her and shamed her as personal, as a believer in America. And so she wanted to change that. And she went ahead and researched the history of this. And she wrote a book titled A Century of Dishonor, about how America had, in fact, failed to live up to its promises in treaties with Native Americans. And she sent a copy of that book to, I believe, every senator in the U.S. Senate, and she hoped that it would make a big difference. And she sat back and waited, and nothing happened. But she was no retiring person. She did not give up, even though she'd spent a tremendous amount of time doing this. She was friends, evidently, with another famous woman writer, Harriet Beecher Stowe. Mm. And, of course, everybody knew what Uncle Tom's Cabin had done for, another sort of American underclass that had, written sympathetically about people who others had not given much care to. And it was a big part of – it was tremendously popular work. And it was also a tremendously rabble-rousing work, in its day. It was made into plays. It was performed all over the country. So Helen Hunt Jackson, decided she was going to do the same thing that Harriet Beecher Stowe had done for African Americans. She was going to do the same thing for Native Americans. And she went out to California to research the history of Native Americans in California, and got hooked up with Henry Loomis, who, of course, was both a California booster and also a very sympathetic to Native American causes. And Loomis helped her. They went around the state. She visited, groups of Mission Indians and tribes and reservations. She also visited some of the old Spanish land-grant ranchos or Mexican land-grant ranchos where, you know, Indians and the Hispanic Americans had worked together side by side for a long time. And she decided that there was this wonderful, beautiful culture, rancho culture, which was, of course, then greatly romanticized in later years, in California, that had been sort of an ideal or a place that she thought. And it had been, to a large extent, decimated by the arrival of the Americanos, by the arrival of the white society that then took over a lot of that land, bought it up or stole it or just inhabited it until you couldn't push them out, and pushed the Indians farther and farther away. And so Helen Hunt Jackson decided to write a novel, a romance novel, something that would be popular just on its own, that would also reveal the humanity, the strength, and the culture that was part of, she felt, was part of Native American society. So that is the genesis of the novel Ramona. It was tremendously successful, popular for decades. I believe it has never been out of print. It's still in print today as a Signet paperback. And at the time, from the 1880s and 90s on up to about the 1930s, it was famous all over the country. People would grab a book of Ramona, get on the Southern Pacific train, come out to California, and go to all the places that were described in the novel because, as a travel writer, Helen Hunt Jackson, of course, had spent time in real locations and had presumably described those real locations accurately in her book. And so people who loved the romance of Ramona wanted to see all the real places that Helen Hunt Jackson had based her famous fictional story on. And there are several places today, of course, that are part of that. She mentions the San Jacinto Mountains. She mentions the area around Hemet, the Temecula and all that. The Alessandro is supposed to be part of the Temecula Band of Indians. She mentions San Diego. She mentions this rancho. Rancho Moreno, which is run by a matriarch. And one of the places that the writer, Helen Hunt Jackson, had visited in California was a Mexican land-grant rancho in Ventura County that was, at the time she visited it, run by a matriarch. That was Rancho Cabulos, near Piru in Ventura County. And so after the novel was published in the 1890s, a photographer came out, took pictures of the buildings at the historic adobe structure and the other buildings at Rancho Cabulos, and they were published in the back of an edition of Ramona as, here are the locations where the story is set. Here is the real home of Ramona, even though Ramona, of course, is a fictional character, sure. But people tended to forget that. And it became famous. Cabulos became famous as the home of Ramona. There's a place down in San Diego that became famous as Ramona's marriage place, although its connection is even more tenuous than Cabulos. And, of course, areas around Hemet and Temecula became famous for having been connected to the novel. And there's another rancho in that area that claims also perhaps to be the home of Ramona.
Now, let me ask you this. Did Ramona have any kind of the impact as Helen Hunt Jackson wanted it to have? For instance, when Abraham Lincoln met Harriet Beecher Stowe, he said, and I'm paraphrasing, I guess, he said, oh, so you're the lady who started this war. Because her novel had an incredible impact on the way people thought about race and thought about slavery. Did Helen Hunt Jackson's Ramona also have that kind of impact? Or did it simply have this romantic impact that was completely the opposite of what she hoped it would have?
Well, the consensus of most historians is that the romance quite outweighed the social issues of the novel in the popular mind. And certainly it's hard to quantify that sort of thing. It's hard to go ahead and look. If you judge it purely on, laws that were passed by Congress, which is a sort of a quantifiable benchmark, then it didn't have much effect. If you judge it in connection to, it's part of a tradition of literature, starting, you know, back with Hiawatha, that honors the Native American soul, and that I think in the early, very early part of the 20th century was not uncommon. You know, the noble red man, the noble savage, the, you know, the person who is, although Alessandro and the Indians portrayed in Ramona are not savages by any means.
Sure.
In fact, they are profoundly civilized pacifists, if anything. But there was a literature, sympathetic to the Indians, and Ramona is a very big part of that. Did it have a major effect on the American consciousness? Probably not the effect that she wanted it to have. But I think it's hard to say it had no effect because it was so popular, and certainly the sympathy of people who read it and who loved it had to go out to the Native American characters, of which Ramona is one.
Now, D.W. Griffith made the first film version in 1910,
mm-hmm.
and at the beginning of that film, starred Mary Pickford, Henry B. Walthall, at the beginning of the film, it says, shot on the very locations. So this is, he shot at the Rancho?
He shot at Rancho Camulos, yes, exactly. He was able to take everybody out on the train because there was a train stop right there for tourists to go there, even though it was a private home. But Griffith made arrangements, shot all the things that occur at Rancho Moreno on the grounds of Rancho Camulos, and then he took his cast, which was staying at the Round Rock Hotel in Piru, about a mile away, up into the hills right above the hotel behind Piru, and shot the ending mountain scenes. And we were actually able to locate those scenes a few years ago. You know, every year it's in September or October or November, you have to watch for it. Camulos, which is now run as a museum for Ventura County, has their once a year Ramona Days. And it's a one-day festival at which where they have all kinds of events, tours, special tours of the adobe buildings. We show the 1910 Ramona film with Mary Pickford and Henry B. Walthall. I talk about it. And they also have people from the famous outdoor play, which is now coming up on its 91st season.
Yeah.
They have excerpts of the play and Spanish dancers who present dancing. They have all kinds of little street fair there that you with artists and you know people who make things and tell stories and all kinds of things. They have a woman who comes up and performs as the señora of the original Rancho Camulos because Camulos is considered the home of Ramona in the popular conception, but it's an important place on its own because it is one of the most important California Mexican land-grant ranchos. It was owned by the Del Valle family, who were tremendously important to early Los Angeles history. And it has a value on its own in addition to the curiosity of being considered the home of Ramona.
Now, when I watch the film, the Griffith film, it strikes me that it was made for an audience that clearly knew that story. Because if you watch it without having read Ramona, and the first time I ever saw it, I had not read it, you can follow it as a story, but there's a lot there that you don't understand, a lot about the characters and so forth.
Well, it's a 400-page novel.
Exactly.
That Griffith
exactly.
had to reduce to about 17 minutes.
But it's something that I don't think we would do today is just assume that the audience would know what
That's
the
true.
Story is and fill in.
Well, I've found that to be true of a number of silent films, early films, that are based on extremely popular literature. Take, for example, Theda Bara's East Lynne, which when it was shown at Cinecon, everybody said, what the hell's going on here? But if you know the story, then what you're coming to the theater to see are how they picturized, to use an old-fashioned word, how they picturized these famous characters and these famous events that you've only imagined in your mind up till now. So I think a lot of people came into Ramona having read the story already, being familiar with it, and you know, if they didn't know it themselves, they could just ask a friend, because almost sure. everyone had read that story. It was popular all over the United States.
Yeah, and it's I think the main thing to recommend that film now is just how beautiful it is. I mean, it's just in terms of all the locations.
It is, absolutely. Yes.
And you were telling me earlier that most of those locations are still pretty pristine.
The I would say about 75 or 80% of the locations in the film still survive pretty much as they were then, with almost nothing changed. And wow. If you come to Camulo's, either on one of their regular Saturday things or for their once a year Ramona Days Festival, and you watch the film, and then you walk outside the little room where we show the film, and you look at the south veranda, you look at the chapel, these are places that are virtually unchanged and sort of held in time. And even the plantings around the adobe are, except for the courtyard, are tremendously similar to what were captured by Griffith's cameras. It'll be 104 years ago.
Yeah, amazing. And you found even the mountain range parts.
Even the mountains. And unfortunately, those aren't easily accessible to people because they're on private land. But we were able to go up into the mountains and locate the exact spots where Griffith shot the later mountain scenes, where Alessandro was shot and, where Felipe finally finds Ramona after searching for her. And it was perfectly logical once we finally found it. If you just take the nearest canyon to the hotel where the cast stayed overnight, and you go up the canyon, there's an old horse trail that you could still find that winds up to the big bluffs that are right behind the town of Piru. And if you stand on the north side of those bluffs and you look northwest, you're looking exactly at the location where that's visible in the background of all those later scenes in the high mountains.
Well, this fall I'm going to go do that because you know how much I love this stuff like that. I just, and especially for the Rancho and all that to have been so unchanged, it's really remarkable.
That
stuff is still there. The 1916 version, only a fraction of that exists.
It was a huge production. I mean, this was made after Birth of a Nation. And the Clunes Company, which was a tremendous owner of theaters, wanted to produce a gigantic mammoth Ramona. They did so with an actress by the name of, I think it's Ada or Ada Gleason, in the title role, somebody who we don't know very well today. Yeah. And I'm wanting to say, now I went to look up who the director was. I think it was Oscar Apfel. Is that right? Oh, I feel embarrassed. I should know this. I have to commit that to memory.
And I don't know it either. So.
Because they made a 14-reel version of the film, of the story. Unfortunately, to the best of our knowledge today, only one reel survives. That reel survives at the Library of Congress. And for a long time, I thought, oh, gosh, it's only one reel. It can't be that important, you know. But I finally got a chance to look at it, and it's really a terrific reel. If that reel is representative of how the whole film is, that was a really good film for 1916. There's a scene in it that I still think about. It is one of the last reels of the film, either the last or the more likely the next to last reel of the film, the one that survives. It includes the murder of Alessandro. It also includes a really dramatic scene in which Alessandro, and let me say, the story of Alessandro's part of the story, the man that Ramona loves and marries, is truly a conscientious objector. He's a pacifist. He's a cultured man who grew up as one of the mission Indians, essentially. He learned to play the violin. Has made his living as a sheep shearer, as with the head of a tribe of Indians from Temecula. And he's, in many ways very European. He does not take up armed resistance, even when he is pushed out of his home 2, 3, 4 times. He will not do that. But what ultimately happens in the novel is he loses his grip on reality. He starts to see everyone as against him. He starts to go mad, in essence, in a sort of a 19th century idea of the mad scene where, you know, he tears his hair out and he runs around and acts crazy. And so in this last reel, there's a scene in which a white man innocently approaches Alessandro, and Alessandro overreacts and thinks that he's come to get him and push him out one more time. And Alessandro goes running back to Ramona, to their little cabin high up in the mountains where they have retired after having been pushed out of all their other homes. And he screams and cries, they're coming after me, they're coming to get me, or something like this. And in the course of doing this, he comes into the scene in what is essentially a medium shot or a medium wide shot. We see Ramona and we see Alessandro in the whole background. He comes right up to the camera so that his face fills the entire screen, and just ranting and raving and nuts, and falls away from the camera then. Now, in most cases, once he gets up close to the camera, of course, that's shocking enough to go from a medium shot to in the same shot where his entire face fills the screen, but that would be the end of the scene. But no, he backs off. The scene continues. And when he backs off from the camera, we realize that the camera has racked focus to keep him in focus the entire time. Now, you know, to shift the focus in the middle of a shot is not unusual today. But in 1916, that's very sophisticated camera work. And in fact, I don't know. I'd love to hear from other historians if they've seen an example of a rack-focused shot earlier than that. It may be the first time it was used, or it may not, you know, because so many of these things were used before we realized them. But when I saw that, I realized they'd racked the focus on the shot. There's also when Alessandro is killed, we cut from the outside where the man is getting ready to shoot him to the inside of the cabin with the doorway where Alessandro is seen in a tremendously dramatic silhouette. And as the gunshot is fired, he falls, revealing his killer and Ramona in the far distance. It's just a beautifully set up shot. And all the action, you know, as long even in 14 reels, the amount of action in that one reel is significant, that a lot of stuff happens in a relatively short time. So, again, if that reel is representative of the rest of the film, it was a beautifully shot, very dramatically done, very effective piece of filmmaking for 1916.
Wow.
I wish I could see the whole thing.
Me too. I want to see that reel. I want to see anything. Let's skip the next one for the time being and go straight to the Henry King version, which I have not seen for a long time. It was shot in Technicolor.
Yes, it was. Full three-color Technicolor.
As the most beautiful woman in the history of the world, Loretta Young. And yes. Don Ameche, right? Where was that shot? Do you know?
You know, I wish I could say I do. I haven't done, you know, it's one of those things I will be getting to that research soon. It looks like it was shot in Southern California. I mean, I've seen it. It looks like it was shot in Southern California, out in a lot of grasslands and mountains and, you know, mountain ranges that are similar to what we have here. It was not shot at Caboolos. I know that. And it does not appear to have been shot, it could have been shot in parts around San Jacinto or Hemet, but I haven't really done the research on that one.
Yeah, it was. I should find that out. King loved to do location stuff. Mm-hmm. So, and I think he only loved location stuff because he loved looking for locations in his airplane. but it would not surprise me to find that he had gone to some specific place or that some.
Well, it's a beautiful film.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, the three color Technicolor is, you know, three strip Technicolor is stunning. 1936, so it's an early three strip Technicolor film. It even predates Gone with the Wind.
Sure.
And, you know, Loretta Young, as you say, is a stunner, although I'm going to put my little chips on Dolores Del Rio. I have my own reasons.
You should. So, well, speaking of Dolores Del Rio, she is in a film that we thought was lost until just a couple of years ago.
A few years ago, yes. Well, there had been some hint about it. Apparently, And I haven't seen this. I've only been told about it. Apparently in the 70s, I think, there was a list of films that were thought to survive or said to survive at the National Film Archive in Czechoslovakia that was you know, that a number of film historians got their hands on. And Ramona was listed there. But then a number of years later, when updated list was provided to to FIAF for their treasures from the film archives, Ramona was not on the list. And so people were afraid that perhaps if it had existed, it might have, deteriorated or been lost or something like that. And so it was considered a lost film until just a few years ago. And it's funny because it has to do with Camulos. The first year I was at Camulos showing the 1910 Griffith film of Ramona, there was another historian, a wonderful woman from university back in the Midwest, Didia DeLizer, who had studied Ramona extensively. She is herself in both the geography and the anthropology departments of her university. And she had written a book called Ramona Memories, which was all about essentially the Ramona tourism and all the incredible quantities of gewgaws and tchotchkes that had been created based on the Ramona and Alessandro legends, and how this all related to different spots. The Ramona's marriage place, Camulos, and the other locations that were specific to Ramona, to the Ramona story. And it's a fascinating book. It's available in print, Ramona Memories by Didia DeLizer. And she was there that year at Camulos showing off her collection of Ramona paraphernalia. And we got to talking, and it actually wasn't until her her partner showed up, Paul Greenstein, with a car that I had never seen outside of Central Europe. And turned out that the two of them had lovingly restored a 1940s Tatra coupe, which was manufactured in Czechoslovakia.
Wow.
And I had been to the Czech Republic a number of times looking for films, recording film scores, doing a variety of things like that. And so I was just blown away. We started talking about Czechoslovakia. And she said, you know, the 1928 Ramona with Dolores del Rio is considered a lost film, but I've heard that it may be in Czechoslovakia, or rather in the Czech Republic, in Prague. I said, well, really? I've been to the Prague archive before. And so right there, on the grounds of Camulos, we hatched a plan to meet in Prague the following spring and see if we could find this print of Ramona. And indeed, we wrote, of course, first to Národní filmový archiv in Prague. And Vyacheslav Haba, the American film expert, did in fact confirm that they had a print of Ramona there, the only print known to survive anywhere. And so we made our arrangements, and by golly, next spring we met in Prague and went to the archive, and they showed us the print.
Wow.
We sat down, we were able to watch the whole thing through, and it was in good condition. It appeared to be complete. There may be an issue with one scene, but I think that was intentionally removed. And we were terribly excited because it looked so good. And because it was there and we were able to see it for the first time. And we were also shocked, I think, although I think this was known perhaps beforehand, that for a film or story that is supposed to happen in California, that great portions of this film had been shot in Utah. In fact, we later learned from Jim Dark, at the Brigham Young University, who's written a wonderful book on filmmaking in Utah.
Let me second that, yeah.
The 1928 Ramona with Dolores del Rio was one of the first feature films to be shot in the area of Zion National Park.
Wow.
So we got terribly excited about this. And we talked to Vyacheslav Haba and Carol Zima there, and they said, well, actually, you're the second film historians to view this film. We said, what? It turned out that not 6 months before, around the time that we were making our plan to meet in the spring, a film historian from the Midwest, Joanna Hearn, from the University of, I believe, University of Missouri, had come out. She'd been writing about Native American filmmakers and stories. And, of course, the director of this Ramona, Edwin Carew, was part Chickasaw Indian himself. He was part of the Chickasaw Nation. So, as was the screenwriter, who was his brother. So Joanna had seen the film first, and she had told the Library of Congress about it. And that was wonderful, and it was confirmed, and then we came out later and found it all over again. but just finding a film isn't the whole story, of course. Finding something in a foreign archive or foreign hands is always exciting and always wonderful, but it's not the same thing as getting it preserved and restored. And at the time we were in the Czech Republic, they had a beautiful print, but they did not have money to preserve the film, because the, of course, you know, budgets being what they are, and in many of these central and, you know, in these many other countries, they may be able to preserve or hold on to the films, but they may not necessarily have the money needed to preserve them.
Sure.
So after we came back, we talked a lot about what American archive would be the ideal one to have Ramona. And I initially thought that a California archive would be the ideal place because it is a California story. But then thinking about it a little more deeply, we realized that, first of all, of course, the original negative of the 1910 Griffith survives, and it is at the Library of Congress.
Wow.
The single reel of the 1916 version of Ramona survives, and that is at the Library of Congress. So the more we thought about it, the more we realized Library of Congress was probably the ideal archive to preserve and restore the 1928 Ramona with Dolores del Rio. So fortunately, we were able to help coordinate a deal between the Library of Congress and the Rodney Filmový Archiv. And fortunately, the head of the Czech archive in those days, which was Vladimir Opela, was open to working with us. And we got it back. I mean, it took months and months of sort of, come on, guys, let's get going. You know, what's the next step? But it was the people at the Library of Congress archive, of course, are wonderful. They took it on, Rob Stone and the team that works with Mike Michon. They took it on and have worked really, really hard on it. Got the film shipped. You know, it's always difficult to ship nitrate prints across over the Atlantic. You know, it's expensive and it takes time to coordinate, and custom boxes have to be made. They got it shipped over. They got they took it through, did a very careful photochemical duplication, from what I understand, and then I put together a team of people to do the to translate the titles, because we looked and we looked and we looked and we could not find an original script. And that was a terrible disappointment because, you know, it's difficult when a title is translated from English into a foreign language and then you try and translate it back. It's hard to get that kind of thing accurate. But what we had was a wonderful resource in Didia and also in Phil Brigandi, who is the former historian of the Ramona Bowl outdoor play.
Yeah.
And so we had Phil Brigandi and Didia, and then also Clara Molacek, who is a native Czech speaker. And we brought her in, and the four of us sat down and went through it. My hope was that we would find some language that would make sense to translate. We might be able to use the novel or the script of the play, because we know that Edwin Carew's company went out and viewed the play when it was being performed in the 1927 year, I believe. And we didn't find a lot of language that related directly to the play. We did find a few phrases that echoed the novel, but Clara was able to tell us that the language of the Czech titles was actually rather rough. It was poor grammar for the Czech language. And so she felt strongly that whoever had done the Czech titles had more or less been translating word for word from English into Czech. It didn't appear that there were too many titles. I know I've been told that a lot of people have run into foreign editions of films where a lot of titles are added, either just because they wanted to do something or because they were trying to explain American things to, you know, foreign nationals. But whatever the case, the whole film, 8 reels long, is told in just 85 titles. So it's barely more than 10 titles a reel, you know. Yeah. It's not too many titles. And it also, I had been involved peripherally in helping to get the Colleen Moore film, Her Wild Oat, back from Prague before, some years before, to the Academy Archive. In that case, we would have been dead in the water without the original titles because there was so much American slang in there. I can't imagine what it would have been like to try to retranslate that.
And a comedy is different.
Yeah, this was a historical tale. So I'm pretty confident we got something at least, you know, reasonably close to the original titles in our retranslation. I'm sorry we didn't have the original script, and if we ever do find it, why golly, I'll be out there saying, hey, let's compare these, let's go back to the original if we can. But we got that done. We translated the titles for the Library of Congress, and now we are, I believe, weeks away from the completed restoration, and we have booked it thanks to the UCLA Film and Television Archive and thanks to a wonderful woman, Diane Allen, who is the granddaughter of director Edwin Carew, who is, of course, interested in seeing her grandfather's work resuscitated. We will be having a great premiere for this new restoration from the Library of Congress here in California at the Hammer Museum in the Billy Wilder Theater on Saturday, March 29th. And it will be a wonderful affair, I think. In fact, we've even made arrangements with the Mont Alto Orchestra from Colorado, the 5-member group, to come out and create a score for this re-premiere. And the leader of Mont Alto, Rodney Sauer, got his daughter, Molly, to do some research. And they located, Molly located, a partial original score, handwritten score,
wow,
produced for the Los Angeles premiere of Ramona. And so Rodney will be using themes. Unfortunately, it's not the whole score. It's only part of it. It's about a third of it, perhaps. Yeah. But he will be using those themes in the new score that he creates for our premiere on March 29th.
That's terrific. I love the Mont Alto Orchestra, so that's really good news. It could have gone a completely different way. But now, you're also going to have a panel discussion afterwards?
Yes, indeed. We'll have, one of the things that's happened since we discovered the film in the intervening years, Linda B. Hall has produced a very important, wonderful biography of Dolores del Rio that deals extensively with the making of this film. And she's at the University of New Mexico. She'll be coming out. We'll have Didier DeLizer there, who helped us find it and create the translated titles. Phil Burgandy from the Ramona Bowl will be part of it. And Joanna Hearn, who was actually the first American to see the print, will be coming out from University of Missouri. And she's written some wonderful pieces on Native Americans and American film. So we'll be doing a little panel discussion afterwards and with those people. And if I'm lucky, I'm going to keep my fingers crossed, we might even get Jim Dark out here too.
Would that be great?
Yes.
Yes. Well, when Jim Dark comes out, he's got to be on the commentary track. I've been bugging him for a year or more. There are some people that it's taken me a long time to get on the show. I finally do, but Jim still eludes me, but his book is great, and his films made in Utah is.
I'll give you the high sign, and you can kidnap him after the show.
I will. I'll tackle him. Have you ever been to the Ramona pageant in Hemet?
Yes. You know, it's funny because I heard about that when I was just a little kid. You know, it's been going since 1923. Every year, except I think they had to take a break 1 year because of World War II. They just had their 90th season. And so Once we started hunting Ramona and we were doing that, I knew I had to go. I remember my mother saying, you know, when I was a little kid, oh, we got to go to the Ramona pageant some year. And we talked about it and talked about it and never quite got down there. But it's a terrific event. You know, they use over 400 performers now. They have horses, they have wagons, they have, you know, team, you know, large groups of dancers, and they perform in this gigantic open air, bowl area with seating for thousands of people. They do it for about 3 weekends each year. And it's, they do it in the afternoon, and it's a tremendous experience. So it's one of those California things that is, perhaps not as popular as it was back in the 50s and 60s, but it is still going strong. And
I've always meant to do it, and for some reason it sneaks up on me every year and is already happening by the time I realize that it's come around again. So it's in the spring usually, isn't it? Like March or something?
Yeah. In fact, it will be happening, I think, in April this year.
Okay.
About 2 or 3 weeks. It opens 2 or 3 weeks after our March 29th premiere of the 1928 Ramona.
Well, we could have a...
It'll be their 91st season.
We'll have a spring of Ramona this year with the film. That's, you know, this is great news because, you know, we all have... lost films that we pursue, and God knows I wrote an entire book of the ones that I want to find. But the fact that you tracked this down or helped to track it down, and more important, got it over here so that we could see it again, is a tremendous accomplishment.
Well, you probably saw David Pierce's report last September to the Library of Congress on the state of preservation of the survival of American silent films, silent feature films. We know that as of the moment, we only believe that about 25% of the titles that were created in that era between 1911 and 1930 still survive in one form or another. But the good news out of that, I mean, it's an incredible report. It's very important. And David Pierce is an important historian who's also, of course, been very important to us because he's created the Media History Digital Library, which is an incredible resource.
Invaluable.
In fact, I used the Media History Digital Library for some of my Ramona research because several places I found written questions about whether or not Edwin Carew had ever made a big deal about him, his Chickasaw heritage until Ramona. You know, the idea was that, oh, well, that might be something that he trotted out at the time that Ramona was released to say, look, I'm an Indian too. but in fact, that's not true. His connection goes all the way back to the 1911 when he first started appearing as an actor, and using the Media History Digital Library, I was able to find, references to him and his Chickasaw heritage back then. That's an aside, but the library is an important place, and every chance I get, I will go online, and about at least once a year, I try and add a little donation to his pot there because they need money to continue that.
They sure do.
It's a very valuable resource.
Yeah, I can't recommend that highly enough. And he, you know, for years now, people, ever since the internet has existed, as soon as it existed, people started saying to me, oh, so now you write your books, you do your research on the internet. And for years I would say, no, you can't do it. You can find some things on the internet. But thanks to this, we've taken a huge step forward.
Absolutely.
In actually being able to do solid research on these things, because the periodicals that he's posted on there are searchable. And I also have been subscribing to the Variety, which is incredibly expensive, but it's every issue of Variety, daily and weekly, and it's all completely searchable too. I found remarkable things there. So we still can't research our books and so forth entirely on the internet.
Not entirely, no.
But it's a lot better than it was. That's
it sure
for sure.
Is.
And stuff like this is happening. And, yeah, I'm so grateful to David Pierce for what he's done. I mean, I've been grateful to David Pierce for a lot of things over a lot of years, but this is incredibly important.
Well, the great thing, I think, though, looking now at specifically at his Library of Congress report, because that woke a lot of people up, as it should. But what he built in there, this idea that we have, you know, of course, some of these films only survive in 16 millimeter. Some of them survive only in shortened versions. Some of them survive in incomplete versions. But he took all the current resources and he added it all up. And people had thrown around different numbers. But he's the first one, I think, to really combine all the available resources and discover that you can add up everything we know to survive. And only about 25% is known to survive.
Yeah.
However, he was working from what we know exists. Now, I have found, or not found, because I say I found, but it's not really the right thing. I went to Prague back in 2001, and I quote-unquote found Her Wild Oat. I didn't find Her Wild Oat. Vyacheslav Haba knew exactly where it was. I just asked for a Colleen Moore film. Vyacheslav Haba grabbed Her Wild Oat out and said, here's a Colleen Moore film, and I don't think you're going to find it anywhere else. And he was right. So, you know, a lot of times, this is a digression, but a lot of times we say, oh, this person found a film. Well, if I went into your library, and looked on the shelves and across an incredibly rare volume and pulled it out, I couldn't really say I found it. Yes. You had it.
It's like,
well, these I got to tell you, these foreign archives deserve a tremendous amount of recognition for what they have done. Those that have collected and saved American films, not everyone has, of course. Some of them stick strictly to their own country's product. But there are a great number of American films in foreign archives, and we don't know all of them yet. The films I've been associated with pulling out of Prague were Hulda from Holland, Her Wild Oat, and now Ramona. None of those were in the FIAF database.
Wow.
So we know that there are films in foreign archives. Prague is an important one, and it's not the only one. And, of course, just last, a couple of years ago now, we had the example of New Zealand.
Yes.
Where a whole bunch of things showed up. So there are other films out there still to be found. And I'm hoping that in the next few years, we can get a much more coordinated, much more categorical approach to searching foreign archives. Right now, so far, so many times, it's been a case of, well, I wanted to find one film, and I went hunting for one film, and by golly, I found it. And that's great. It's wonderful when it happens. But when we can get a longer time in country, when we can sit down and go through everything that's there, both the things that are identified and the things that we can't identify. Very often when they change, in foreign versions, they change the title, or there are films where they're missing the opening title and you just don't know what they are. There are a lot of unidentified films in foreign, archives. It's time to go really take a serious look and take some time and, do major exploration work there,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, there's so much out there. I'm sure that we're going to find some great things that just haven't been uncovered yet.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite story, I might have told it on the podcast before, but I think it was in a French archive. They had Lon Chaney's film Unknown, The Unknown.
Oh, yes.
And it was labeled Unknown. And
perfectly logical.
For years, people kept passing it on the shelf saying, you know, one of these days we need to look in there and see what this is. And sure enough, it turned out to be The Unknown.
Well, I know Kevin Brownlow has examples of films where the titles just got completely changed.
Sure.
Something that was practical, but is nothing that you would even remotely translate back into the original American title. And of course, there are all kinds of other examples.
Yeah.
So it's exciting to know that there's still stuff out there to find. Of course, once in a while, we get something like that marvelous discovery in the New Hampshire barn.
Oh, know, yeah.
Of a Pickford
sure.
Imp title, her
amazing.
Very first one.
Yeah.
But that's getting domestic discoveries like that are rarer and rarer these days. It's, you know, you never say never because it can always happen again. But there is, we know that there is, if we explore in foreign archives, there's a lot still to discover.
It's driving me crazy because one of the films that I wrote about in my book, Lost Films, which is an important film to me because it was filmed in South Carolina, the state where I was born and reared, as painful as that sounds, mm-hmm. Called Pied Piper Malone with Thomas Meehan and Lois Wilson. A print showed up in Russia. Now it's still in Russia. We mm-hmm. know it's there. But so far, nobody that I've been prodding has been able to figure out how to extricate it from Russia and get it here.
Mm-hmm.
But it was discovered in Russia probably 6-7 years ago.
Yeah. Well, of course, we did have an example of a digital repatriation of American films from Russia that happened a few years ago to the Library of Congress. And I'm hoping there'll be more to come from there. I did, of course, have my own tragic Russian experience when we were researching the documentary Theta Bera. You know, we had heard that there was a single reel of Theta Bera's Camille at Gosfilmofond outside of Moscow. And it had been shown, in fact, at the Bologna Film Festival 1 year and late at night. And I heard from somebody that there may have been some controversy over it, over to whether or not it really was what they said it was. But a lot of people, you know, had seen it and accepted it as Theda Bera's Camille. So I was able to make arrangements to get into Gosfilmofond and look at it because we wanted to find some lost film of Theda Bera, you know. There isn't very much.
Sure.
You know, three features survive and the two shorts well, one short, really, and then a single shot in another short. And so I was able to – it took a bit of doing, but I was able to get to Gosfilmofond. And there may have been a more in those days – this is back in 2005 – there may be a easier way of doing it now. But at the time, I was having trouble getting responses from them via email and so on. So I didn't. I did send an email, often heard nothing. But I had a friend who had a friend who had, I think, a friend who supposedly worked at Gosfilmofond. So I decided maybe if I just go there and show up on their doorstep, they'll let me in. Not really the method I recommend for the future, but sure. You know, I, at the time, that seemed like maybe it was the thing I needed to do. So, in fact, after I had visited the Pordenone Film Festival, I was already in Europe. It didn't cost that much money to get a plane flight to Moscow. And I would plane flight up to the Domodedovo, I can never say that name, Domodedovo, something like that, airport in southern Moscow, which is actually about a 20-minute cab ride from Gosfilmofond, which is in a little village south of Moscow. And so I got my plane flight there, and I got a hotel room. And I sent my message to my friend to pass along to his friend, to pass along to her friend, saying that I was ready to come to Gosfilmofond and would very much like to look at this lost Theda Bera film that they reportedly had. And I got a message back down the line saying, we cannot let you in until we have an official request to view films on your company's letterhead. So I called from Moscow. I called Los Angeles and got one of my partners and said, would you please type up an official request on our letterhead and fax it to this number? And he, in turn, typed it up and tried to fax it, and it didn't go. And he just decided to wait an hour and tried to fax it again, and it didn't go. And he waited again. And he just decided he was going to go. He was determined. He was helping me out tremendously. He said, I'm going to just do this every hour until it goes through. And he kept trying all day long and all into the night. And at midnight, it went through. Because, of course, midnight is 9 a.m. Russian time.
Well, sure.
And that's when they turned on the fax machine. So the fax machine finally got turned on at 9 a.m. The fax went through. I got I got my official invitation back, and the next day I took my cab ride and took the 20-minute cab ride over to Gosfilmafond, and there in this little village called Belia Stolby, which I think means white tower or something, or white column or something like that, there's this huge sign with pictures of Charlie Chaplin and a famous Russian actress and somebody else. And it says Gosfilmafond on this little back street. And there was the entrance to this huge campus, beautifully, laid out of these old buildings that had, where incredible collections of film is held. And I was taken into a building to meet assistant head of the archive, because the head of the archive was out of town at the time. And I sat down, and this wonderful fellow with this great Russian face is facing me across on the other side of the desk. And he says, "So, what is your problem?" And I didn't know, of course, whether he meant, "How can I help you?" or "What the hell are you doing on my doorstep?" Which probably was closer to the truth. But once we got started and I told them what I was there to look for, they were tremendously helpful. They turned me over to a fellow who became my my handler there, Oleg Botchkov, who spoke beautiful English and was very helpful. And he took us through. We pulled out a number of things that I asked for, but most, of course, I wanted the Camille. Well, he said, "We have three silent Camilles. We have a single reel of Theda Bara's Camille. We have a single reel of Clara Kimball Young's Camille, which was actually made a year or two before the Theda Bara version. And then we have a single reel version of Camille that was done by an Italian company. And these were all identified by an Italian researcher," which makes perfect sense. That's why it ended up in Gosfilmafond. So I got out the reel of Theda Bara's Camille, and I put it up on the flatbed. It actually had been, it wasn't nitrate I was working with in this case. They had, in fact, preserved all of these things on acetate. And my heart fell when I looked at the screen, because it was not Theda Bara. Mm. By that point, I had looked at several thousand Theda Bara pictures, and every available piece of Theda Bara film footage, and as soon as I saw it, I knew it was not Theda Bara. But I couldn't believe it. I looked at it. I said, no, I've got to be wrong. I've got to be mistaken. This has got to be Theda Bara. But I went through the entire reel. It was the last reel of the film, the story, this the time in which she dies. And I said, okay, maybe it got mixed up in the can somehow. I mean, rare, but it happens. So I got the Clara Kimball Young Camille. It was the same film.
Ooh.
Except the one that was identified as Clara Kimball Young was one of the first reels in the film. And the one that identified as Theda Bara was one of the last reels of the film. She's got tuberculosis, and the eye makeup gets heavier, So maybe that's what set them off. But somehow or other, it had been identified by an outside researcher as being Theda Bara, and it really wasn't. But I was so concerned that I might be misseeing it, that I even snapped some pictures off of the ground glass screen and later showed them to Kevin Brownlow, who apparently had been there at Bologna when it was shown. And he said, "Oh my God, I can't believe I looked at that and thought it was Theda Bara. It clearly is. It is Clara Kimball Young. Everybody sees, everybody recognizes Clara Kimball Young, don't they?" So the power of suggestion being what it is, sure. It was presented in Bologna as Theda Bara. A lot of people looked at it and thought, "Well, okay, it's Theda Bara." I mean, when you're in a week-long festival with films going nonstop, somebody says, "Here's Theda Bara," and I guess you just, you tend to go along with it.
Yeah.
But, no, we had two reels of Clara Kimball Young and no Theda Bara. So I sadly informed the Russians of that and did look at some wonderful other stuff that they had there. And I hope that, Clara Kimball Young film apparently does survive in other archives. But I hope that some of the other stuff that's there, like the Pearl White House of Hate serial, which they have most of the most, if not all, of the episodes there, or the they have several reels of Mary Pickford's 1922 Test of the Storm Country, which we only know is surviving in 16 millimeter, and the 35, while somewhat beat up in the copy I saw, is nevertheless infinitely sharper and more detailed than the 16 millimeter. So I hope that that someday will be part of a new restoration of Test of the Storm Country, if they can find enough footage. Maybe someday.
Yes.
Don't give up. Keep pushing.
That's the thing. Never say die.
Yes.
Well, I know that you have a thing to get to.
Yes, indeed.
And so we should bring this to a close. But this is great news about Ramona, and I'm really
so excited.
Really
can
eager
I,
to
can
see
I pitch it.
It
again? Can I pitch it again?
Pitch
okay,
away.
Okay, yes, yes. Everybody, come on down. Billy Wilder Theater tickets are available right now online, and we hope to sell it out. So I'd say order your tickets soon, please. And this will be Saturday, March 29th, 7:30 p.m., the Mont Alto Orchestra, the granddaughter of Edwin Carew, the biographer of Dolores del Rio, and the historians who found and translated the titles for the for Ramona 1928 with Dolores del Rio and Warner Baxter, directed by Edwin Carew, will be have its re-premiere,
yes.
Or in any event, its premiere of the new restoration produced by the Library of Congress with the aid of Narodny Filmový Archive in Prague, Czech Republic, which had stored the single surviving print. We will have our premiere, and we will have a big party.
It once was lost, but now it's found.
Yes.
So through the amazing grace of film preservation, we see it again. So this is great news. So thanks for being here, Hugh.
Oh, thank you, Frank. I sure enjoyed it.
I hope you enjoyed that talk with Hugh Monroe Neely and are now ready for some good Ramona watching, because there's plenty coming up. Again, he said, he repeated it, but it's March 29th, 7:30 p.m., tickets are $10, a pitifully small sum for such an incredible bargain. If you need to go to UCLA to see if about buying tickets there, you know, take this down. I'll also put this on the website because I know that you're not going to take this down. But it's http://www.tft.ucla.edu/event/special-screening-ramona-1928. So, hey, quick, tell me that back. Read it back to me right now. You'll find it. If you just go on and Google UCLA Ramona 1928, you'll find it. It's there. It's easy to find things on that internet. Easy, I tells you. So I hope you do that. And if you do, come up and say hello to me, because I'll be glad to meet you. Claire will be there. We'll be sitting uncomfortably in those seats and have a great time with the Mont Alto Orchestra, who we love. And if you haven't heard my interview with Rodney Sauer, the head of that organization, I hope you'll look back through the archives and find it, because it was a doozy. And we love listening to them play. And I can't wait to see this film. And I think the panel discussion will be fascinating, if not interesting. And speaking of Claire, who I've mentioned on several occasions on this episode, I need to thank her. Thank her from the bottom of my heart for being my announcer. I need to thank him from a slightly up from the bottom of my heart, because after all, I'm not married to James Hutchins. I'm married to Claire. But I'm thankful to James Hutchins for designing my website. My websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. Hope you'll visit them both early and often. Of course, I want to thank the wonderful, gifted Rob Clearfield, the legendary Gary Rand, who wrote my wonderful theme music. I love this theme music. We're heading well into our second year of this podcast, and I never tire of it. And of course, they wrote the fore and the aft. And I want to thank you, the loyal listener who is telling friends, who is going onto iTunes and leaving a nice review and a 5-star rating, who is spreading the word so that someday my dreams of world domination will come true. And if not that, if I might just be able to pay the rent. I really, my dreams don't have anything in between those two things. So help me achieve one or the other by helping make this podcast more popular than it already is. That's not going to be that hard to do when you get right down to it, because it ain't so popular. It's beloved by those who listen. Mostly. I got my first kind of negative review, but it wasn't even negative. It was complaining about one specific episode, but he started with the heartening, the life-affirming, "I usually like what you do okay, but this episode I hated." So, but, you know, you need a little bit of sour to make the sweet even sweeter. That's the way I looks at it. So we'll have another great guest coming up for you next time, and I hope you'll join us then. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.